There's enough real things to worry about, not to have to consume yourself with things that may not happen. And a niece who lives in New York woke up soon after the election, I think feeling very homesick, and said, "Is this the end of the world? You know, what country is this?" And my thought was, well, look, here's three books that I found useful in helping to sort of dissipate non-specific anxiety, if you like. Things that I think there's consolation in history in taking the long view. And one of those is called The Idea of Decline in Western History by Arthur Herman. Now, it's 20 years old, and it has its flaws because it hasn't aged well, but the first half is a very interesting history of the idea of decline. And the picture you get is that there is this persistent view that is centuries old that the past was better than the present and that decline is inevitable.
Civilizations rise and fall, and the fall is now. We're always saying that, aren't we? Oh, now it's this is it.
Anytime.
The empire's falling to pieces.
Exactly. And he starts with a list of books written in the second half of the 20th century that talked about a rising underclass, the crisis of democracy, all inequality, all the things we're hearing about now.
It's ringing bells like jingle bells.
Exactly. Then he goes back to the origin of that genre in the 20th century, which is a book called The Decline of the West by someone called Oswald Spengler. And then as the book progresses, he just progressively goes back to the 1850s and then to 1750s, where Jean-Jacques Rousseau was talking about how the origin of commerce gave birth to competition and exploitation. The arts made men soft and effeminate. Human beings became physically weak. So this idea of decline is persistent. It's part of our cultural heritage. And there's something mildly comforting about just reading that and realizing that this is what people have thought.
That conservatives have been telling people that art makes you soft for hundreds of thousands of years. Yep. It's interesting, isn't it? There's a similar thing you can find about grammar that's just got quotes going back every 50 or 100 years, right to, in fact, Roman times, saying these kids, or Greek times, I think, going, these kids don't use grammar properly, language is falling to pieces, and their writing's rubbish.
Yeah. Exactly. The second half of this book, sadly, is somewhat flawed because it came out at a time of real triumphalism. It was soon after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and there was a book, a now infamous book called The End of History and the Last Man, that said, okay, well, that's it. Cold War's over. Western liberal democracy has won. That is the high point of social and cultural evolution in humans.
Watch it now sweep through every other country effortlessly in the world.
Yeah, and he called it a bit early.
Yeah.
Now, this guy was infected by a bit of that. The second half of the book you forget. So this is one to get out of the library. Don't buy
okay.
it. But the first half is...
It's got reassuring chops.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, the second one is a different kettle of fish. It's called...
And this one's a good Christmas gift, I think, this one.
So do I. I agree. This one is much more recent. It came out in 2012. It's called The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker. And the name might be familiar because he's one of the four curators of the current exhibition at MoNA.
Which will still be running after Christmas. So
Absolutely.
That's why it's such a great gift idea, because you go, here's his book, his thing's on at the thing, go and look at his stuff.
He's on a different subject here, but this is a fascinating book. What he's done, it's 1,000 pages. It's a book that you want to dip into. It's not a book you read from cover to cover. But his basic argument is that there has been an unrelenting, centuries-long decline in violence amongst humans, and that might strike people as very hard to believe. The standard figure that he uses throughout the book, there are, I lost count of how many graphs, the number of violent deaths per 100,000 people. And it has declined from about 100 per 100,000 in the 12th century to between 1 and 10 in the 20th century. And it is an unrelenting decline.
And this is because your feudal lord can't gallop past and lop your head off because he doesn't like the look of you anymore.
Well, he gives two basic reasons that he calls the Leviathan and gentle commerce. And the Leviathan is code for Hobbes's The Rise of the State. So if you go back to 15th century Europe, there were 5,000 individual political units. So these were principalities, duchies. We give them all these noble names. They're essentially warlords.
That's what we would call warlords in Africa,
exactly.
The dudes driving around on the utes. Hello, there's the utes again with the machine guns.
Yeah,
and
they
the
just
machetes.
Had a big horse and armour.
Yeah,
but it was the same sort of deal.
Exactly the
Violence
same.
Violence rule.
And all family-based and tribal.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's gone from 5,000 political units down to 50. So the rise of the state, what he said is, and there's a lovely quote, if I can find it, that we agreed to surrender the satisfaction of vengeance for impartial law. And gentle commerce, trade, was the positive sum game of mutual benefit that came out of trade. Now, even commerce and trade was frowned upon. You know, St. Augustine wrote all these things about usury and money lending, and, you know, no businessman would ever go to heaven. You know, commerce and business was frowned upon.
It was seen as very grubby, something that happened in cities.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the emergence of those two phenomena, the state and commerce, is what he attributes that to.
Does that hold, do you think, then, for states that don't operate on our rules? Can you say, oh, well, China, the state and commerce that's working? Can you say, I don't know, Cuba?
Well, he points to this phenomenon to different degrees in many different countries. It's a very exhaustive survey. But what is interesting is about America. And even though he's Canadian, he now lives in America, and he makes the point that America is somewhat an exception to this rule because the populace did not surrender the right to violence to the state to the same extent they did elsewhere. You look at the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. It's always been a more violent society ever since that. So there wasn't that complete surrender to the state. But then where the book gets interesting, you get this picture within the first couple of chapters, but then it's the exceptions to this rule that are interesting. And one of the most obvious exceptions was between 1960 and 1990, particularly in the US, where there was a spike in this figure, the number of violent deaths per 100,000, which he attributes to the baby boom, affluence, and believe it or not, the transistor radio. For the first time, a generation could understand that lots of people thought like they did. And there was a tremendous sense of solidarity. There was wealth and affluence, and there were a lot of things to complain about, Vietnam, the civil rights movement. And there was a spike in violence that was a very steep rise and then an equally steep decline in the 90s. So it's a fascinating examination of history. But overall, the thing is, life is far more violent than it was, even taking into account all the deaths in war, purely because of the number of people. So it's always, his figure is the number of violent deaths per 100,000 population.
That's The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker. And then the final one, Simon Sharma.
Simon Sharma. Now, you might have seen documentaries of his, History of Britain.
He's so good.
Wonderful. Okay, this book is an
art history stuff's amazing.
Gem, absolute gem. You can read it at many different levels, but his basic argument is landscape is as much a form of human expression as is poetry, prose, and art.
Does that mean gardening?
It means gardening, but also it means landscapes at scale. So geography shapes the way that humans live, but we shape nature. And we shape landscapes. We create landscapes, and they become part of our cultural memory.
Well, China does, don't they? They're making whole new islands.
Everybody does. And there's an American writer, Wendell Berry, who said, of the American settlers, and it's the same of the first Europeans who came to Australia, they came with vision of former places but not the sight to see where they were. And they didn't know what they were doing because they didn't know what they were undoing. So we came with an idea of what a European landscape should be and tried to recreate it. And it's taken 200 years until someone like Bill Gammage could write The Biggest Estate on Earth, which is about how Aboriginal fire shaped the Australian landscape. That's taken an awfully long time for people to realise. And then I don't know if you've come across Bruce Pascoe's book, Dark Emu, about Aboriginal agriculture. If you don't believe there was an Aboriginal agriculture, buy that for Christmas. Buy two copies. Keep one yourself and give one to a friend.
That's Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu, which is really fascinating. I mean, you'd think how elementary debates still are about middens in Tasmania. That's an example of the landscape being changed and shaped by habitation.
Absolutely. But not only that, but cultivating crops and animals, eel farms in Western Victoria. Fascinating book.
Really good book. So there's some books that you could get for Christmas. The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker, 1,000 pages of reassurance. Landscape and Memory by Simon Sharma. The Idea of Decline in Western History by Arthur Herman. And the bonus book, Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe. How about that? Some reassuring reading. Thanks very much, Ted.
Pleasure.
Have a happy Christmas.